Anyway, there'll be a couple of new Sandmen in there tomorrow.
How do you know?
Some of our guys are on Carousel tonight, and Sandmen always renew, I know.
But you don't know, you just assume. One for one. What everyone's been taught to believe. One for one.
Well, why not? That's exactly how everything works. Keeps everything in balance. One is terminated, one is born. Simple, logical, perfect.
You have a better system? Of course not. At least I wonder about it sometime. Not like you with your automatic one-for-one routine. You sound like a sleep teacher with a stuck tape.
Logan, leave it alone. It's perfect.
Some people will say a gay woman who's a Christian minister just can't get elected in the South. Not to mention she's a Democrat. But I say an insurrectionist who flirts with Nazis and fires up a violent crowd to attack our democracy.
Wow, this crowd has some fight in it.
Well, he shouldn't get reelected anywhere.
Capricorn 15s, born 2244. Enter the carousel. This is the time of renewal. Be strong, and you will be renewed.
What happens, Rod, when reality is replaced by faith?
So you're talking about people not looking at what's in front of them, but just going by faith alone.
Well, and not necessarily in a theological sense, although that's sure where we are headed today. So if you don't want to talk theology, today's probably not a good show to listen to. But so wow. In the film Logan's Run, which is still one of my favorite classics.
Yes.
And the biggest mistake I ever made, one of the biggest mistakes, I mean, there were bigger mistakes, but when it came to entertainment mistakes, buying Logan's Run in Blu-ray is a huge mistake. Don't do that.
Okay.
I'm just going to tell you, it doesn't look as good in Blu-ray as it does in standard def. Okay, I'm just going to leave it at that and let you go on your way. In the film Logan's Run, the two main characters, Logan and I'm having a terrible time with names, his partner. They come to this existential discussion about why are you thinking about things? Why don't you just accept things the way they are?
Jessica Six.
Not Jessica, the guy's partner.
Oh, the guy's partner was Francis?
Francis.
Seven?
Francis Seven, that's him. Logan Five, yeah. Francis Seven. So, and Logan is starting to question things. And remember, they're in the nursery, and they're trying to figure out which kid is whose. And it doesn't really matter because the way of things now is different. The way of things now is better. And you're not supposed to question it. You're not supposed to think about it. Because if you start thinking about it, what happens?
Well, it could lead you down a dark path, according to the powers that be.
And why don't they want you going down that path?
Well, because, you know, you might realize what's really going on and decide to, I guess, take the power for yourself?
Could be. And given what will ultimately happen downstream, maybe that's the case. Maybe it isn't. I don't know. There's another character in this that fascinates me, Box, the ice guy. Mm-hmm. Who is just singularly focused on his programming, his task, that he ignores all the reality around him. He's catching food and freezing it so that we have the freshness of the sea. And when the food stops coming, he just switches to something else. And he's single-minded in this. And he's a robot, so why would he? But he never questions, why am I doing this? And that seems to be this ongoing thing here. Why will nobody question this?
Mm-hmm.
There's an old Ferengi proverb. Yes, Dave has finally started watching DS9.
About time, Dave.
How long ago was that? 1990 something?
Something like that. It was a while ago.
I'm in season one, episode five. And I'm actually enjoying it.
Yeah.
So that's remarkable. There's an old Ferengi proverb, never ask when you can just take. And it seems like we've kind of forgotten that, haven't we? We not only do we not ask questions, we don't even take anything. We just take stuff for granted. We just take it as it is. And we just assume that they are correct. Did you know that masks will cut down on the spread of disease?
Did you know that two masks will do even more? Because if one does it, two's got to be better.
Did you know that the world is heating up and global warming is caused by human beings? In a billion years, that's not going to matter, right?
No.
Because the oxygen...
Yeah, I sent you that article.
Right.
The oxygen's all going to be gone. We're all going to die.
Right, because of the sun's heat, the Earth is going to overheat and the oxygen breaks down. And then what do we breathe?
Yeah.
Now, of course, that doesn't take into account the fact that you could still use electrolysis and pull it out of the ocean. But really, who wants to walk around with a machine on your back so you can breathe? Of course, I won't be here.
Isn't that kind of where we're headed with this whole virus thing anyway? People are walking around with masks and pretty soon it's going to be respirators.
Yeah. Complete aside, having nothing to do with the show we're talking about today. So DS9, episode 1, season 4, some virus infects the station. And I sent Rod a note this morning. I'm so triggered right now because if this virus is everything they keep saying it is and everything they're afraid that it is, they're doing everything wrong.
Yeah.
And of course they do everything wrong. And guess what happens? Everybody ends up with a virus.
Yeah.
But thank God for television and MacGuffins, because they managed to solve it by finding the person that made it. And anyway, point being of all this, that when you're asking questions about things, religious faith, reality faith, it replaces it. And to some degree, this is true in religion as well, theologically speaking. To some degree, it's true as well, because, and I can only speak for myself here. This is only me. I'm not telling you what your religion tells you. I'm not telling you that your experience must be the same as mine. It's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, in my experience, I was often greeted with that answer to my questions. You just have to take it on faith. You just have to not question things. I don't know what your experience was, but I got that a lot, particularly when I was younger.
I didn't get, apparently I didn't ask those questions because I was never told that. But part of it, too, is growing up, you know, my father was the music director for our churches that we attended. Whenever we'd move, he'd be the music director of some other Methodist church. And so I was raised in the Methodist church, but I never went to Bible to Sunday school because I could always sit in the service and doodle on the bulletin and sing the songs and listen to the messages.
Didn't we all do that?
Yeah. It was great.
My dad was the pastor, and I still did all that. And I don't know. I remember distinctly when I actually started listening to him, and that just led to questions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my faith tradition where I grew up, and for those of you who do not know, obviously, you've not listened to the show for very long, but I grew up in the Salvation Army. I am the fourth of five generation of family members that have been heavily involved with the Salvation Army, which is a branch of the Wesleyan Armenian theology. The closest to the Salvation Army in the non-Salvation Army world would be the Nazarene Church.
Okay.
In fact, our ordinations used to be, I don't know if they still are now because I've been out for 20 years, but they used to be pretty interchangeable. In other words, if you left the Salvation Army, you could go to the Nazarene Church and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, point being that that's where I grew up. And we had a book. I probably have a copy around here somewhere, although I don't know where. Probably 3/4 inch thick, called the Handbook of Doctrine.
Okay.
And it's a theological level course in our theology, in Wesleyan Armenian theology, and particularly as it applies to the Salvation Army. Now, I can tell you that at one point in my life, I probably had that book memorized. I don't anymore. And so any of my old friends running around going, how can you not remember what's on page 18? I'm sorry. I just haven't read it in that long. And quite frankly, I don't care anymore. But we were encouraged to know that book forward, backwards, inside out. And then when I went to seminary, we had to take classes on it, which was, you know, I got in trouble in seminary class, theology class one day, doctrine class, because it was the day for the final exam.
Mm-hmm.
And this instructor, teacher, whatever you want to call him, comes in and hands out a piece of paper. And the piece of paper says on it, I, fill in your name, promise that I have done all the reading and homework and am ready to take this test.
That's funny.
Well, it would be. I looked at it and said, what the heck is this? Well, I don't want anybody saying that they weren't taught something because this is a particularly hard test. You know, this is doctrine class. Like, I'm not signing this. Why not, Dave? Well, and this is when I was much younger and a long time ago, because I'm a first-class petty officer in the United States Navy with a top-secret PSYOP ESI clearance. If I fail the test, it's my fault.
Yeah.
I don't need your paper to tell me that. Anyway, the first of a long experience in seminary that was not great. Anyway, point being was we were well steeped in all this stuff, and I felt like I could have a reasonable conversation with it. But Rod, even then, there were a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think my approach was in dealing with these questions? Do you think that I said to myself, well, I need to ask everything, or do I need to become, you know, extra zealous because that way it'll look like I actually believe this stuff?
I think that you probably went and continued to ask and research the questions.
That's what you'd hope, right?
Yeah.
No, I became the this is our doctrine and you believe it or get out person.
Really?
Yeah, I really did. And eventually I got to the point where I realized that this is not answering my questions. You can't just take things on faith. You can't just hold up your hand and go, renew, renew, renew. You ever actually see anybody renewed? Right?
Yeah.
And at that point I realized, well, that approach isn't working for me. And of course that led to a lot of self-introspection and eventually my conversion. Where I find myself in Judaism now, which is where we have a completely different look at some of these things and is completely irrelevant to what we're talking about today.
Sure.
Because we are going to talk about Protestantism in the United States. We're not going to talk about Roman Catholicism. So those of you that might be Roman Catholics.
Catholics?
Is that a word, Catholics? I like that better.
You're just... your emphasis is a little different.
Emphasis is on the wrong syllable. and we're also not talking about Judaism, except in brief comparisons, because in the history of our country, like it or not, Protestantism has been the dominant faith branch.
Yes.
And within Protestantism, how many different denominations do we have?
Oh, man.
Come on, just in your city.
I can't count how many there are.
Not even going to try, huh?
I'm not even going to try, no, because I know that there's more than a handful.
When I was a Salvation Army officer, I was assigned to Toccoa, Georgia, which is a town of 8,000 people. In the entire county, there were only 15,000 people. You with me here?
Sure.
There were 32 churches within a five-mile radius.
It sounds like Escalon.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah.
I mean, do we really have that many differing beliefs that we can have 32 churches? Just to get letters all the time from the divisional staff. How come you don't have more people attending Sunday school? Why aren't you out beating the drum to get people to come in? Look, there's 32. Somebody doesn't want to be. It's believe me, if there's anybody unchurched in Toccoa, Georgia, it's because they want to be unchurched in Toccoa, Georgia. And sometimes managers don't really understand that concept, which is, again, by that point, I was deeply questioning some things, and on we go.
Dave, you're just failing at your job if you're not bringing those people in that don't want to be church.
And see, that's an article of faith, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's an article of faith in the sense that you are personally responsible for going out and preaching this stuff. And if you're not doing that, then somehow or another, you are a failure. How does that play into free will? How does that play into this idea that I personally am responsible for what I'm doing, like taking a test in theology class, or that I am personally responsible for my own interpretation of things, my own application of those things, and my own use of those things? Not just what I believe, Rod, not just whether I believe this verse or that verse, or whether I, you know, see because we talk about this all the time. Two people can read exactly the same verse in scripture and come to completely radically different conclusions as to what it means.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there's a verse in Isaiah about a virgin giving birth. Christians automatically assume that means Jesus. We Jews look at that and go, no, no, it doesn't. So how do two reasonable people come to those kind of conclusions? And if we're talking about free will here, which is a, what's the word I'm looking for, a foundational principle of Protestantism, right?
A part of it, yes.
Wouldn't you say it's more than just a part of it? I mean, hitherto, the Protestant Reformation
mm-hmm.
was free will really something that was taught, preached, understood?
I don't think so.
Of course not, because that's the whole thing. Right. You have to willingly accept the gospel rather than some priest bapping you upside the head with an offering sure. plate saying, give me an indulgence or else.
Yeah, you need to come to church or...
Right. Now... Again, I'm not completely familiar with Roman Catholicism in the sense of their theology, and there may be some element of free will to it, but we're not talking about that today. The idea of solo scriptura, in other words, only scripture can interpret itself and I can do that myself, was unique. It was something mm-hmm. brand new, and it allowed people to become more responsible in the sense of free will themselves. All right. So just again, we're not talking about Catholicism. We're not talking about Judaism, because we want to look at this in the context of the United States and our own history and where we are right now. So when all these various denominations, 32 in Tekoa, I don't know how many in Escalon or wherever, look at a verse in the scripture and applying the concept, because Protestantism does, of sola scriptura, we interpret this ourselves via scripture, and boy, you get into sola scriptura, now you're into real issues, because is it only scripture or is it something else as well? We're going to leave that aside for the moment, okay?
Yeah.
But
can of worms.
Well, it's not really, I mean, it's something I really enjoy, but I don't have freaking 4 hours to do this today.
and people will stop listening.
Will you people really stop listening if we go that way?
Good question.
Send us an email, dnr@thedavebowmanshow.com. I'd be curious.
Yeah.
Because normally we're just hysterically funny, but today I don't think we're going to be.
No.
Although we might be. You never know.
Not very Goliard-like today.
Oh, I disagree.
Okay, there you go.
I completely disagree with that.
I only have an outline, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I sent Rod the outline this morning going, I don't know how closely we're going to follow this, but... We did something unusual this week in the sense that we've been talking about this, doing this for 3 or 4 days. I actually called Rod last night, which I never do.
That's what I was like, Dave's calling? Really?
Because I hate telephones. You know why? Because I hear voices in them. So I actually called Rod, and we probably spent 10 minutes last night, me trying to tell him, this is where I think we want to go. But anyway, none of that matters, because when – two Protestant denominations read a verse in the scriptures and come to, would you say that they come to the exact same understanding? Let's take a concept, caring for the poor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Some denominations look at that as meaning we have a commandment, a directive, an obligation to physically go out and take care of the poor, whatever that means. In some cases, it means we're going to house homeless people, we're going to do this, we're going to... Other denominations have the attitude of, I don't have to actually do it, I just have to maybe support those who do, or at least not actively oppose it.
Yeah.
Agreed?
I would think that there are faiths that believe both of those, yes.
Okay, so how do they define the... How do they decide what the difference is? How does a faith say to itself, well, this is what it says... This is what we're going to do. That's an intriguing question to me, especially coming from where I came from.
Well, I think it all depends upon, one, how they read into it and what other scriptures they're using to support that position versus, well, this is what it sort of means, is that as long as we're taking care of the poor, it doesn't have to be that we have to actually be doing it, as long as we're supporting it and maybe contributing to it.
Okay, but aren't they reading the exact same scriptures?
They are.
So how do we get to the point where they see it differently? What causes that? That's my question.
It's through the filter of our own minds, basically.
Our own experiences?
Experiences? Our feelings fall into that? Understanding? Our
own political beliefs?
Yep.
So it's not just sola scriptura, is it?
It would seem like it's not.
So, that said, I come, again, as I said, from the Salvation Army, which is noted for its social work.
Yes.
Okay. The Salvation Army was essentially founded because William Booth, its founder, who was a member of the Methodist New Connection and a card-carrying member of the Chartist organization. You know what a Chartist is?
Nope.
A Chartist in the 1850s and 60s in England was an ardent anti-disestablishmentarianist, meaning that Chartists wanted the royalty, the royal family abolished, the monarchy abolished.
Okay.
William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, was a card-carrying member of the Chartist organization. And then he goes out in the streets with his army to preach about saving England from whomever. And he's surprised when the English authorities react negatively to that.
Sedition?
Anyway, complete aside that has nothing to do again with anything. But his basic philosophy was that no one can listen to what you're preaching if they can't hear you over their stomach rumbling.
Boy, that totally makes sense.
It does. So feed them first, and then they will listen to what you say. Now, this has an interesting effect because my father's first assignment as a Salvation Army officer was a place called the Harbor Light Center in Denver, which was essentially a homeless mission. And there, the opposite approach was taken. This is why I joke about when I was 11 years old, my best friends were winos on Larimer Street in Denver. Because I knew those guys, you know. Anyway, there they had to listen to Dad preach first, and then they got to eat. But at least they had the promise of getting to eat, so I guess it worked. At any rate, the Salvation Army has made its reputation on this social services idea.
Yeah.
And even I carried this forward. When I became an officer, and then after I was an officer and still working for the Salvation Army, I opened the homeless shelter in Modesto. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of the work for it and managed it for many years. And then, quite frankly, between you, me, and these four walls, homelessness is something that has always been an issue to me. I see it differently than most people do, but...
Well, and that's part of your experiences that right. are tying into that.
But it is something that, given the choice between working with homeless, not anymore, but working with homeless and not working with homeless, I would always choose to work with the homeless. Anyway, so would you then look at the Salvation Army and say to yourselves, okay, people who tend to lean towards these social ideas, these social problems, using their faith to drive towards social betterment, where would they tend to fall on the political scale?
I would think those that are focused socially would be more left-leaning.
Why would you think that?
Well, because the left seems to be more social types of services and things, government-sponsored, you know, programs. And
why is that? Do you have any idea why that is the way it is? Because there's a reason, and I'm not asking you questions just to – but there actually is a reason.
Well, I don't have a good answer for that one. I would have to think about that some more to come up with that, but I'll okay. leave it to you.
So we'll head down that path then. So this idea develops in Protestantism in the late 18th century with the Enlightenment. This idea develops that it is our religious duty to, I don't know if you can hear that or not, but it is pouring rain here.
I can't hear that.
It's our religious duty to meet the social aspects of the gospel. In other words, we have to house the homeless, we have to feed the poor, we have to clothe the naked, we have to visit the sick, we have to, you know, did you not visit me in prison kind of thing. Yeah. This is not seen as metaphorical, it is seen as absolute. And as capitalism begins to really take hold and economies improve and the wealth of a nation begins to improve. And by the way, when Adam Smith wrote that, he didn't mean, you know, how much actual gold do you have? What he meant was, what's the living standard of a nation?
Uh-huh.
As the living standards improved, more and more people were lifted up, but the poor went further down. Uh-huh. At least that was the perception. And so the social gospel, as it would become to be known, began to focus more on a moralistic responsibility to help the poor. Now, this was in opposition to economic interests, which may or may not have been headed up by people of faith, right?
Mm-hmm.
Economic interests at the same time were more interested in higher profits, better margins, lower costs.
Yeah.
And so there was this diametric opposement between economic conservatism, for better lack of better phrase, and religious liberalism. So the higher the economic status went, the more the social gospel aspect of things began to say, hey, we need government policies, we need church policies, we need to be more active in the social aspect of things. And this really took hold, believe it or not, in Denver, Colorado in the late 1890s and into the 1900s.
Okay.
And Denver, Colorado, of all places, is the firebed. What does that mean? The hotbed?
The hotbed.
Of the social gospel. Well, a firebed would be hot, so.
Yeah, it would be.
It's the hotbed of social gospelism, this idea that the church needs to influence the political aspect of the day. Okay. So that it provides more of a social safety net and so that the government does more for the poor. And it's here in Denver that, in an attempt to show that it can be done, they form a thing called the community chest, where everybody is encouraged to just, instead of donating money to your denomination and that program, just put it all in a community chest and we'll divvy it up for them.
Oh, yeah.
Which eventually becomes the United Way.
Really?
Yeah. So it makes sense then that that's the United Way then comes from a very politically liberal ideology in the sense that it's a faith-based liberal ideology. Now, again, I'm not using that in a negative term. I'm not saying political liberals are bad or theological liberals are bad. What I'm saying is this is where it comes from.
Yeah.
But still, the economic interests have different goals. The people that are actually producing the economy that's allowing people to donate to this stuff still want lower costs, bigger margins, bigger profits, right?
Yeah.
And so there's no reason for them to really sync up with the social gospel folks. Make sense?
It does.
There's no common ground between them other than, once I pay you your wages, I don't really care what you do with them.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a resistance to the idea that the economic interests are interested in because the social gospel folks are trying to use government to force them to behave differently. Does this sound at all familiar to anybody? I mean,
oh, doing all the time now, right?
Yeah. But
wear the damn mask.
Right. This, of course, is something Adam Smith talks about quite extensively in his book, The Wealth of Nations, which isn't the actual title, but there you go. It seems they have opposite goals. So what happened? We don't talk about the religious left today, do we? We don't talk about it at all.
Not a whole lot, no.
Well, actually, we're starting to, which is where this whole thing started, as I came across an article about why you need to pay attention to the religious left. And Rod and I, how did we get on this? Somehow or another, we found a Twitter account for a candidate. How did we find that? I don't remember.
I don't know. I know that I'm always perusing Twitter for different articles, and I send them always to Dave, and it's quite the rabbit hole of an experience throughout the week as we go through various articles back and forth. Yeah. So it was somewhere in that.
We had to open that up to people is what we ought to do. Hey, you want to follow along with us? Here's how you do it. Because this is our thought process for how we put together that hour on Sunday. Anyway, bottom line is we came across this Twitter account for a woman who's running for Congress out of North Carolina. And she's a Democrat, which is a point she tries to make for some reason. I'm not sure why. Her Republican opponent is the incumbent, and he is a hardline Trump supporter, I guess. He spoke at the January 6th rally, and he used the word fight.
Uh-oh.
So, you know, he's an insurrectionist.
He is.
Anyway, as it turns out, she's also an ordained pastor, an ordained minister, and she is a lesbian.
Okay.
Which is causing right now, I'm just going to say this, many of our conservative listeners right now, their heads just went because the idea of a lesbian minister to them is an anathema.
It is.
They can't deal with that. It's a non sequitur.
Sacrilege.
Right. Now, why do they think that way?
Well, because their biblical background from a conservative's point of view is against homosexuality in general.
Okay.
And, so you have this. And then there's the whole women preaching thing. So.
Yeah. Well, again, I come from an organization, sure, the Salvation Army, where women preach all the time. Not very well, but they do. Anyway.
You can send your letters to.
Yeah. You know where to get it. And you know who I'm talking to as well. Anyway, point being. Sorry. That's a complete inside joke that most of you will never get. So what we've developed here then is a political moral ideology based on religious moral beliefs. Going back to sola scriptura, right?
Yeah.
We say, or they say, I got to quit using the term we and they because I'm neither. The Christian conservative is going to say, the scripture says this about that, and I believe that. The Christian liberal is going to say, sola scriptura, but experiential has to play into this, right?
Yeah.
And we've come to believe in modern times that it's the phrase, everybody love everybody, love is love, ta-da-ta-da, so it's okay in our view. And I'm not here to argue with which view I support or which view I defend. I don't care. What I care about.
Getting into that.
Right. What I care about is we've developed these two political ideologies. Let's just label it left and right. I don't like those terms, but liberalism and conservatism in a religious standpoint, in which you have one side defends gay marriage, abortion, social work. The other side is opposed to gay marriage and abortion, the two probably most divisive issues in our country, and sees social work as more of an individual responsibility as opposed to a government mandate, right?
Yeah.
One side wants to use the government to force these things. The other side wants government to stay out of it and believes that we can do it without that.
Yeah.
Community chest, right?
Yeah.
That's where it's gone. So that brings us up then to the 20th century. And again, this is very compressed and it's very, I don't even know what the word for this is. This may be our worst show ever, Ron. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. This is what happens when Dave gets to thinking. When you come to the 20th century though, the social gospel tends to die out. Why? A couple of things happen. Again, you had these economic interests that had they had nothing in common with the political interests of the religious left, right? I mean, they were diametrically opposed. You're trying to cut our profits and increase our costs, you know, wages and that kind of stuff. You're trying to get rid of child labor, all things that the Salvation Army, by the way, was deeply involved with. you're trying to force the government to tell us what to do, blah, blah, blah. So they had this headbutting, and they never had anything in common. All right? So along comes World War I. World War I is, as I said the other day, it is the most incomprehensible conflict in human history. I mean, it just is. Its beginning made no sense. Its conduct made no sense. Its ending made no sense. Nothing in World War One makes sense. You can't look at it and go, okay, this definitive evil had to be defeated. People tried. I mean, Woodrow Wilson tried to put it in those terms, but...
Sure, because you need an enemy.
Right, you got to have one, and it never really worked. And so we ended up jailing people who disagreed, and that's a story for another day.
Yeah.
But the destruction that this thing wrought tended to cause people to step back and go, wait a minute, do we really... Because, again, many of the monarchies, the governments of Europe, were deeply in bed with religious faiths. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were driven by religious faiths. The King of England is the titular head of the Church of England, which, by the way, William Booth wanted to get rid of because he didn't like that. That said, there was a tendency now to look at human beings rather than in the sense of their promise and their potential. There was a real backlash going, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
But there was a resurgence, Rod. What happened? First, you had the economic boom of the 1920s, and all of a sudden, wealth started going up again.
Yep. The roaring 20s.
And as wealth goes up, what happens to the poor?
Yeah, the poor
go
down.
They don't really go down. What happens is the disparity between the two makes it look like they do.
Yeah.
It's like people talk about poor in America today with their... 3 televisions and 2 cars and
cell phones.
Cell phones and that Internet. Kind of stuff. Right. Compared to the poor in Zimbabwe or something.
Even the homeless have cell phones.
Oh, God. Yeah. Do you know that that's the number one of the biggest problems we had when I ran the shelter was having enough power outlets so people could charge their phones. Yeah. I'm not kidding. So at any rate, the disparity became more apparent. And so the social gospel started coming back again. And people began to say, okay, we need government to really help. And then you had the Great Depression. You had the stock market crash, boom, Great Depression.
Then you had a lot more poor.
Now, all of a sudden, you got this huge disparity where the rich are getting richer. You know, the top 1% are getting, and everybody else is going. So, but now you have a president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who is deeply steeped in this social gospel app. This is what he was raised in. Mm-hmm. Went to school with it. He and the government start seeing this as a moral responsibility to take care of people. This is what government is for, in their view. And so you get the New Deal, and you get really what is the logical conclusion of the social gospel now controlling government's policies to take care of social issues.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What happened?
Well, you know, isn't that when Social Security started and all of this stuff? And
sure, all that happened.
Yeah.
So why isn't the social gospel then the dominant prevailing theology today? World War II comes along.
Yeah.
And in World War II, you have what can only be defined as absolute evil.
Mm-hmm.
An absolute evil has to be defeated. Well, how does that square with social gospel issues?
It doesn't.
It's part of the problem. So people begin to ask questions. Ever actually seen anybody renewed? And the whole concept of the social gospel goes out. But in the meantime, the religious conservative movement sees an existential threat in the idea of Nazism and Japanese imperialism, because they know that if these succeed, they watched what happened to the church in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And they see this as a direct threat to them. And so now they have an interest with the government in defeating Nazism, and they have an interest with big business. They have an interest with the economic folks in defeating the existential threat of Nazism and Japanese imperialism, and for the record, Italian imperialism, although nobody really counts that. So... And so there's this moral shift in the government that we need to be more moral people, more independent, more American, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And push our directions with this. And when World War II ends, the absolute horror at the discovery of what had happened really does a lot of damage to the idea that social welfare, social gospel is based on, that human beings, you know, are great and everybody's good. We just need to find the good in everybody. That's pretty clear that that's not the case. There are people and governments and businesses and all the like that are just flat out evil. Pastors that are just flat out evil.
Yeah.
Right. When it becomes obvious that the Roman Catholic Church knew about some of these things and maybe they did, maybe they didn't. Who knows? The bottom line is that the social gospel really takes a huge hit to the interest of the average person who no longer sees the social gospel, the social welfare gospel, as supporting the things that they politically support.
Yeah.
Right? Lower taxes, better prosperity, quit screwing with the businesses. You're doing things to businesses that are causing problems. And as if that isn't enough, along comes the greatest existential threat to that point ever seen in the world. Godless communism. Now, godless communism is, well, something I spent my whole life fighting, which is interesting to me, because now I'm looking at it a slightly different way, not in a good way, but it's an existential threat to the nation because they want to defeat the United States and replace our government with a communist government. Same with the West, same with all these things. But there's also an existential threat here to business, economic interests.
Yeah.
What happens in communism to businesses?
They don't exist.
They get nationalized. They get taken over. They get kulak, de-kulak dies or whatever. And churches, well, we already know what happens to churches in communist governments. And how do I know this, Rod? How do I know what happens to churches? Go on and ask me.
How do you know what happens to churches?
Because the Salvation Army has a very famous officer. He's passed on now. Who had been a Salvation Army in what would eventually become, or what was at the time, Czechoslovakia.
Okay.
When the communists moved in. And it was almost, I don't want to call it required, but it was pretty common in my youth in the Salvation Army that not only did you have to read his book, but then you had to go listen to him speak. Because he would make the rounds around the entire United States telling us about how bad it was under the communists for Salvation Army officers, Christian ministers. And we better not let that happen here. So that's how I know. Anyway, he's a nice old guy. And by the way, he settled in Denver. So we got to see a lot of him. Like everybody else. He was a nice guy. I mean, I really liked him. But he was, and it's not that his story was bad or false or anything like that. And then you start getting the, do you remember the Bible comic books with the guy that used to smuggle Bibles into East Germany?
Yeah, I vaguely remember that.
You start getting those stories and stuff like that. This existential threat to the church, to the Christian church, plays into this idea of American patriotism, because you got to stand up and oppose communism, right? Salute the flag, say the pledge, sing the national anthem, all those kinds of things. Really
church,
begin
God,
to take
country.
Business has the same concerns because communism is an existential threat to them. So there's this natural gravitation, my enemy's enemy is my friend. Mm-hmm. Between religious conservatives and economic conservatives, which are not the same thing, they tend to unite into this singular ideology. Perhaps we could call it the moral majority.
Yeah.
Or Reaganism.
That could be, yeah.
Whatever name you want to put onto it. And that union becomes like a valence bond. Despite the fact that businesses do things naturally, this is what Adam Smith said, this is not me. Despite the fact that the businesses do things that are contrary to the ideas and teachings of religious, whether it's conservatism or liberalism, right? The conservative Christian right has stuck to its business principles because they see this as advantageous in the sense of controlling government.
Yeah.
And instituting policies then that oppose those issues of the social welfare, and specifically abortion, gay marriage, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So up to this point in time, nothing has undone that union.
Yeah.
World War I, World War II, communism undo the social gospel's union with government. But to this point in time now, since 1990s, nothing has really been able to undo that relationship between economic interests and the religious right. Check?
Check. I'm
That's
with you.
That's a long journey to get to where
we're. That is a heck of a long journey.
And we're only scratching the surface of this. We haven't even, I mean, you could really go deep into this kind of stuff. But what are we beginning to see now today? Well, like I said, Rod and I clicked on this gal that's running for Congress, and she is making a huge deal of the fact that she is a lesbian Christian pastor running against a Trumper, an insurrectionist. I mean, she basically says that. And now we're starting to see more and more religious type input into the political arguments of the day, aren't we?
We are.
So you have to, the religious agenda of the social gospel type stuff, I mean, gay marriage and abortion are legal, both in the United States of America, despite the attempts of the conservative right, Christian right, to undo that. Now, business is going to look at that. If I'm a business guy, am I going to look at the business realities of the day and say to myself, right now we have a situation where businesses say, well, I don't want to serve X kinds of people.
Sure.
Is that going to continue?
I don't know. You know, I always I go back and forth on this because if I was a business owner, would I want to market to certain people and maybe not,
not
serve
just marketing,
others?
Right? Not just marketing, but
right.
But let's say, okay, I'm going to give you a good example here. When I was in the Navy, I had a boss in the Navy that actually owned a hotel in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Really?
This was in the 1980s. And it was just his side job.
Okay.
Somewhere along the way, he'd scraped up enough money to buy a small hotel in Virginia Beach, which is a seaside resort town during the summertime. Yeah. But it is also the place where it's called Greek Fest, happens every Labor Day weekend. Greek Fest is the traditional black college version of spring break in Daytona.
Okay.
So thousands upon thousands of African-American college students descend upon Virginia Beach on the last real weekend of summer, and it becomes a miniature Daytona Beach, right?
Yeah.
In the late 1980s, I don't remember exactly what year it was. For some reason, 89 sticks in my head, but it might have been 90. There was a huge riot. I mean, it was a big enough riot that the Virginia Beach Police Department turned a tennis court into a temporary jail with razor wire and everything
okay.
else. It was a big enough riot that the base at which I was stationed, which at the time was the home of what was then called Dev Group 6, now known as SEAL Team 6, was based. Okay. And there was concern that the rioters would try to breach the base. And so actions were taken to make sure that that did not happen. Okay?
Okay. I'm following you.
This was a big enough riot for that. So the next year, the controversy in Virginia Beach was many of the larger hotels began shutting down before Greek Fest. Business interest here.
Sure.
I don't want to serve those kinds of people because, you know, problems, this, that, and the other. And I remember this day, my boss, who owned this hotel, was a guy that I just did not, he and I did not get along at all. In fact, when I went to his retirement party, because he retired from the Navy shortly after this, everybody was stunned that I went to the party. I mean, people were like, what the heck is Bowman doing here? And he comes over to me because we hated each other. I mean, we just didn't get along. He comes over to me. He's three sheets to the wind. He puts his arm around me and says, I know why he's here. Everybody just stopped. I mean, the whole party just stopped. People look at him and go, why? What? He just wanted to make sure I'm really leaving. And I laughed. But, you know, I learned a lot from that guy. Anyway, we were sitting around the office and someone said to him, because we had a couple of black guys working with us in the office. And one of them was asking, you know, are you going to open? You know, and it was very accusatory.
Yeah.
are you going to open? And he looked at them across that whole room and he said, you know what? I'm so tired of this nonsense. The only color I see is green.
Yep.
You're damn right I'm going to be open. But I tell you, I'm going to get a premium for this weekend. When business interests start to diverge from the religious interests, whether they're left or right, what ends up happening? The power of that religious control, that religious mm-hmm. influence starts to wane. And what are we seeing happening here? Would you say that the conservative religious right is on the upswing or the downswing?
Politically? I would say downswing.
And do you start to see why now? Because there's no existential threat.
Yeah.
There's nothing to hold that valence shell, to hold business, economic interest to the conservative religious interest anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And until there is, what happens? Which way do they go?
It's going to go back to the social.
It's going to go back to the social side of this.
Yeah.
Until there's a paradigm shift, nothing changes. I mean, it has continued for the last 40 years. Right. It is. And for the last 40 years, it stayed where it is because there's no paradigm shift. There's nothing to change it. But now what's happening? Now, once again, I know this sounds like it's counterintuitive, but economically, things are getting better, which means that the perceived disparity is doing what again?
Getting bigger.
Which causes, even though it's really not, but the disparity is perceived to get different, which means that those on the social welfare gospel, the social gospel, see it now as, well, why can't, how often do you hear this phrase? How can the wealthiest nation in the world not take care of people?
Yeah, all the time. A living wage, Dave. We need a living wage.
We've got to have a living wage. Got to have $15 an hour. It's not going to solve your problem, but you know, you can believe that it is. And yet, until that paradigm shift happens, until Logan goes outside the city
mm-hmm.
and sees that things are not the way that he's been told they are and taking it on faith all these years,
yeah,
nothing changes. And I think it's the same for us. Those of us who are steeped in the political and theological right, politically speaking, haven't been asking the right questions. And so now we're sitting there going, we're stunned by what's happening because we have no idea how we got here in the first place.
Yeah.
We just think it was always this way. And it wasn't. It wasn't always this way, Rod. Once upon a time, things were much different. Yeah. And it wasn't considered necessarily a bad thing. I mean, In the late 1800s and early 1900s, it was normal for churches to try to influence the government to provide social nets. I don't know, man. I like I said, I come out of the Salvation Army where social welfare is a huge thing, but I don't think anybody would ever accuse the Salvation Army of being politically liberal. but I think once upon a time we were, they were, I'm not there anymore, but so it's remarkable to me. So when I see this ad for this politician, what intrigues me most is not that there's a gay lesbian pastor running for Congress against what someone she says, and it's an insurrectionist and a Trump supporter. What intrigues me is, there's a gay lesbian pastor now openly pushing this because the pendulum is shifting.
Yep.
Boy, that's a long way to go for that, isn't it?
It is.
What do we do about it? That's the question. Or do we do anything about it? Do we even need to do anything about it? Because again, I converted fully to Judaism, which sees things much differently.
Yeah.
Those that are in the Roman Catholic persuasion probably aren't seeing that. I love watching those folks on Facebook because your pontiff is clearly a social gospel person.
Yes.
But your church is clearly not. So what are you doing? And depending on what denomination you are, it really affects how you're seeing things outside of there. you get into the whole evangelical issue with, you know, Trump was sent by God and, you know, that's, it's a little, it becomes very Logan-esque in my way, in my way of seeing things, because there's this absolutism in this, we cannot be wrong.
There is.
There's no free will here because we have to believe this. We can't ask questions. And if we ask questions, well, we might not get answers we like.
Yeah.
But did you ever see anybody renewed?
Yep.
Nope. We did not. I'm Rabbi Dave.
And I am Friar Cook.
And I know it didn't sound like it, but this has been...
What the frock?